And, you know, and there's something about the power I got back by using my fists. And I think I only understood power by force, not power by words or actions that weren't fights.
Right. Very well said. You started taking acting and improv classes, and then you discovered the Upright Citizens Brigade. How did that experience change your life?
You know, it's funny to say, like, improv has changed my life. But improv comedy, if for people who don't know, it's a form of comedy that is really based in a unique experience that the audience has with the performers on stage. The performance on stage is dictated by what is said in the audience. It's really magical. It's sometimes very hard to translate because you are capturing a vibe, a moment. And it's not like stand-up. You can't do the same improv show. You know, I was reading this book about Nichols and May and the magic of the improv there and finding things and going deeper. And when I saw the Upright Citizens Brigade, it was this electric energy. They were doing improv, and it was a fresh form of improv. They were young. They were in their 20s. It's Amy Poehler, who you know from Parks and Recreation, and Matt Walsh, who you know from Veep, and Ian Roberts, who's a fantastic writer, and Matt Besser, who does stand-up and improv and comedy. They all were these dynamos performing on stage, and they would bring their Chicago friends because they were originally from Chicago. I saw them in New York. But people like Tina Fey and Rachel Dratch and Adam McKay, these people who were just, again, 20-somethings who are trying to make their way. And it blew my mind. It felt like, oh, my gosh, this is this form that I love. Because I had been seeing the other side of improv that was very much like, whose line is it anyway? Very simple, fun. I loved it. It blew my mind there, too. But this was like improv that was cool. This was, you know, and again, going to that Mike Nichols and Elaine May book, or the Elaine May book, I should say, that I just read, you know, I think many people were so excited by them because it was at this time where it felt like jazz, it felt like this electric, it felt like we were breaking the form, and the UCB, I really do believe, brought that breaking of improv and making it cool. Like, there's a book called This Band Will Change Your Life.
Michael Azarod, is yes. that his last name? Yes.
I love that book. And there's a lot of similarities between that book and what we were doing in the comedy scene. As a matter of fact, another book called Meet Me in the Bathroom literally is the parallel book of the UCB. What was going on in New York at that time, where indie bands like The Strokes and Yeah Yeah Yeahs were performing in small clubs, we were doing for comedy. It wasn't as cool, but it was like, you know, like, and I think that there, like, it just captured a moment. There was a zeitgeist there. It was a time before cell phones. It was a time before, you know, not cell phones, but like, everything being posted, you know, it was this ability. You had to be there. You were showing up. You were getting your $5 tickets. It was awesome. And it did. It changed my life. It made me want to commit to this world so heavily.
Mm-hmm. I'm just curious. The Elaine May book you mentioned that you just finished reading, yeah. is that the one, Miss May Does Not Exist?
It does. Yes. Yeah. That's
yeah. 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 Carrie Corrigan. I don't know how to pronounce her last name. Yeah. I'm 150 pages into that. That's a great book.
Yeah. I just finished it last night. I just couldn't stop. I couldn't stop reading. I was kind of at first watching some Elaine May movies and then reading a chapter on it. And then I just went and just started it and read the whole thing right through.
Oh, cool. Way to go. I look forward to finishing reading it. In 2001, you auditioned for Saturday Night Live. How did that go?
Look, I was very lucky to be picked to audition for truly the most iconic show in television history. And if you talk to a lot of comedians, many famous ones, they've all had their SNL experience. You know, you've kind of plucked from obscurity. They make you sign a contract where you sign away your life for 7 years and for the chance to be on the show. And regardless of what you think of the show, it is that opportunity. It's like, well, you have to take it. Like, I've never met anyone who said no to it. It's just historic. So when I was asked to do it, it was incredibly exciting to be there. And I was the first of my peer group to do it. And it was daunting. And I think a lot of the SNL audition, which people don't realize, is a mind game. I don't even know if it's an intentional mind game, but it's like they're going to see you on their schedule. So come in at 2 o'clock and you might audition by 9 p.m. at night. They're not in any rush. Like they have their own things going on, you know. And I was auditioning at the time when Tina Fey was a head writer on the show, or at least on her way to being the head writer, I think, at that point. You know, and it was this amazing opportunity to be on that stage and perform you know, for these people. But that waiting game, that 2 to 9, was truly, you know, a test of your patience. And I actually think that they want you to, they want to make sure that you won't crack. Because by the time you get on that stage, you have to still be at 100%. And that's, I think, a lot of what that show is. That show is endurance. That show is getting through it, making it, being unaware of what's happening, and just trusting the process. But one of the best parts about it was, like, after a few hours of just being kind of like, oof, I need to, like, clear my head. I got to get out. But I couldn't get out of the building. I couldn't even leave the little room. Just open the door, and who do I bump into but Kevin Hart? And Kevin Hart at that point was not the Kevin Hart that we know. Kevin Hart was like the me that I was. You know, we were both those young guys that were just trying to make it in comedy. And he had worked with some of my friends, and I knew him from my friends saying, oh, this guy's really sweet. He's awesome. We had a great time on our pilot together. And it was just so fun to talk. And you know, years later, like maybe, you know, like many years later, I bumped into him. And it was an immediate connection because we've both been through this like trial by fire. You know, he didn't get it. I didn't get it. Obviously, his career is insane. But it's like you always remember that. You remember those little moments.
Yeah. Which chapter of your memoir was the most difficult for you to write?
The one that I had the hardest time not cutting, you know, because I'm a stickler. I love to cut things down. Maybe it's my comedy instincts or whatever it is. I'm just a believer in like shorter is better. You want people to go, I wish it was longer, not I should have ended, you know, 5 minutes sooner. And so there's a chapter I wrote about being diagnosed as having ADHD in my 40s after I had my kids, you know, and it was something that I was really kind of not embarrassed by, but it's something I don't talk about. I didn't want it to be like a crutch, like this is my thing. But when I talk to people about it, they're like, you have to leave it in. It helps me understand my husband who has it. It helped me actually understand myself. And what I've found is so many people have experienced something very similar to that. And I think that, you know, we live our lives through a lens that only we know. You know, your color purple is different than my color purple. And sometimes we just take for granted that's the way I am, that's my brain. But there are sometimes reasons why we act certain ways. And it really changed my life for the better as I got older to know this about myself. And I was able to do so much more. You know, it's only been like a couple of years knowing this, but I feel relief that I did it. And writing that chapter was easy to do because I can connect to it and I feel it. But wanting to share it with the world was embarrassing to me a little bit because it wasn't something that I had really discussed outside of my inner circle of friends. But I found it to be actually one of the chapters that most people talk to me about as something that they really identify with.
Well, that's great then that you had the courage to include that, and so other people can relate to that. That's great. Paul Scheer, thank you very much for joining us. Congratulations on Joyful Recollections of Trauma.
You're amazing. Thank you so much.
Paul Scheer is an award-winning comedian, actor, filmmaker, and podcaster. He is also the author of Joyful Recollections of Trauma. Find out more about Paul and his memoir at wpr.org/beta.
Whatever is extremely relevant to today that is in the book, it's just an echo of history.
Coming up, novelist Mateo Ascarapor takes us 500 years into the future in seconds with his novel, This Great Hemisphere. I'm Doug Gordon. You're listening to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio.
Morning Edition from NPR News asks the crucial questions of our time.
Who can make the best cookie, humans or AI?
Unpack the answers with us every weekday.
Support for WPR comes from Wisconsin Dells, with indoor water parks and theme parks, dining, entertainment, and more. Information on holiday happenings at wisdells.com. Wisconsin Dells, the water park capital of the world.
Support comes from Sylvan Learning of Kenosha, offering personalized tutoring from certified teachers that's designed to inspire, convenient scheduling, and affordable hourly rates. Explore the options, search Sylvan Learning of Kenosha, or call 262-694-6286.
This is WPR News.
Hi, I'm Doug Gordon. Welcome back to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio. One of the most memorable guests I've had on the show is novelist Mateo Ascarapur. His energy is almost contagious. He was on a few years ago to talk about his startup satire, Black Buck. That novel became an instant New York Times bestseller. Maybe after our interview? Maybe not. So how did Mateo follow up on the success of his debut novel? Did he write a sequel called Black Buck Part 2?
Yes.
Of course not. He wrote a 400-page doorstop of a novel called This Great Hemisphere. It's set 500 years in the future. It's a sci-fi epic that, you know what? I'm going to let Mateo break it down for you. He returns now to Beta to discuss his sophomore novel and why he took great pains to distance it from his stellar debut.
I remember 2020. I was on my friend Irvin Weatherby's rooftop, and I was saying, hey, man, you know, we're really going to go hard on this sales angle in terms of Black Buck. The book is coming out in a few months. I'm not going to shy away from the fact that I was a salesman. I mean, I set the book in the very building that I worked in. However, in doing that and playing that up and in generating the excitement and the hype around it, I know that it could be difficult to extricate myself from that when it comes to writing another book. But I plan to go in a completely different direction to show people that I'm not a salesman who had happened to write a book, but I'm a writer who had just happened to write about sales. So I had already had the idea for what would become This Great Hemisphere in 2020, even though it wasn't fully fleshed out. And it was orders of magnitude more difficult to pull off, but I got what I wanted out of it. And I do believe that I expanded myself as a writer and that I'm better for having written it.
Mm-hmm. And I think we're better for having read it. Can you tell us a bit about This Great Hemisphere? And you touched on it, but I want to get a little more information about why you decided to write it.
Yes. So This Great Hemisphere is set 500 years in the future in a world where there are invisible people who are literally see-through, and then members of the dominant population who have visible skin. It focuses on a young woman, Sweetmint. Now, when the book opens up, Sweetmint's brother, who she had lived with, who she loved, who was really the only person that she could call family in her life or blood in her life, has disappeared. He's been gone for 3 years. She's moving through that grief as much as she can, and she gains an apprenticeship with the premier inventor of the land, one of two men who had rebuilt the Northwestern Hemisphere from the ashes. Now she's working with this man, and then one day she finds out that the head of their hemisphere has been murdered, and the primary suspect is her big brother, again, who she had presumed dead and was definitely missing. Now there is a political upstart, a member of the dominant population running on an anti-invisible platform who says, I am going to become elected within 5 days and we need to find this guy. Then there's the top law enforcement officer in the land, also a member of the dominant population, who says, no invisible is going to upstage me. I'm going to find this guy in 5 days. And then there's young Sweetmint, whom the hemisphere thinks nothing of, whom the hemisphere believes she is powerless, who says, no, I'm going to find my brother in 5 days. So it is a novel about many things: siblinghood, love, family, duty, ambition, power, as well as what does it mean to see and be seen.
Yeah, very well said. So how did you come up with this idea of the invisibles?
The idea came to me from an experience that I had in 2019. I was on the New York City subway sitting down, and an older man and a woman walk on, and the man turns to the woman asking her where she'd like to sit. And as he awaits her answer, he just points at me while sitting directly at me. And it was such a strange and surreal experience, because it was as if in pointing at me, he wasn't even perceiving me. He was more so perceiving an absence, whereas I was present. And they walked toward me, and I was just, Doug, I didn't know what was going to happen. I thought one of them was going to sit on my lap. I didn't know what was going to happen. And then they just wedged themselves into the half a seat beside me and, you know, sort of pushed me a little bit. And at night, I lay in bed more so out of curiosity, wondering what happened. It wasn't any self-pity. It wasn't any feeling bad for myself, but more so just trying to understand, did this man not really see me? And if he didn't see me, then what did he see? And those questions then gave way to other questions because, you know, as you know, we writers, we do our best to take control of a narrative rather than having a narrative take control of us. And the questions began to form of, you know, what if there were a race of invisible people? They're invisible, right? But what would they look like if they could be seen or perceived? How do they become invisible? Would they be revered by folks who aren't visible, or would they be subjugated and oppressed? How do they live? Where do they live? How do they love? Where do they love? What amount of levity is present in their lives? What amount of tragedy or darkness is present in their lives, and how do they persevere through it? And soon, Doug, these questions gave way to answers, and these answers formed into what would become This Great Hemisphere.
Mm, yeah. And your two epigraphs also refer to invisibility. Could you share them with us?
Let's do it. I am invisible, understand, simply because people refuse to see me. When they approach me, they see only my surroundings, themselves, or figments of their imagination. Indeed, everything and anything except me. Ralph Ellison. And the second epigraph. Invisible to whom? Toni Morrison.
Hmm. Thank you for reading those. Yeah. You wrote this novel from a fascinating point of view. It's close third person POV. Can you tell us a bit about that, what that is and why you took this approach? Because I'd never encountered it before.
So when I first drafted the novel, I was trying to write a short novel and I failed. And someone who had read an early version said, this is an outline. Go rewrite this entire thing and go build a world, you know, which was great advice. They also said, you know, 2/3 of this is written in close third person. Do you want to write in close third person? If so, you know, go streamline the entire novel. And I said, I don't know what close third person is. maybe it's due to a lack of having an MFA. I don't know, but I had to Google close third person. But close third person is essentially third person, but limited from the perspective of one person, right? So with Sweetmint, when I'm writing about Sweetmint, I am limiting the perceptions that I write about to her own. I'm not going to have her in a scene with her and a surrogate father of sorts named Rusty and share Rusty's internal thoughts as well or his perceptions of what's going on. It's just limited the scope of Sweetmint in that way. And this book uses a multi-POV, so three main characters or three main perspectives. There's Sweetmint, there is Stefan Jolis, the political upstart that I spoke of, and then there's Leon Kurtz, the top law enforcement officer, or aka Hemispheric Guard, the director of the Hemispheric Guards that I spoke of. So when I'm in those chapters from their perspectives, it's written in third person, but limited to their own points of view.
One of the biggest challenges you must have faced while writing This Great Hemisphere is all of the world building you had to do. What was that like?
Yeah. I'm chuckling from trauma. So the book continued to get more and more and more difficult until it didn't. And in writing the world, at first, I was overcompensating. I was writing every single little detail of every single place and every single person. And I was overcompensating because I was writing 500 years in the future. And I, at first, you know, foolishly thought that the more minute details I provided, the realer the world would be. But that's just not how we exist. And that's not how vibrant places come alive in a novel. They come alive through contrasts, right? If I am pointing out every single little detail, then almost no detail matters and no right. detail stands out. So my incredible and incredibly gifted editor, Pilar Garcia Brown, helped me see that and helped me pull out from draft to draft to further highlight the aspects of this world and the aspects of these people that I wanted the reader to see and I wanted the reader to feel. But before I even gave it to Pilar, I had written two or so drafts, perhaps three. And because I didn't outline the novel and the questions were just piling up, whenever I'd pull the thread of one question, 15 would fall out. And they were piling up and piling up and piling up. And they were hard to keep track of. So after the second or third draft, I stopped and I opened up a blank Word document and I put world building at the top. And I just allowed myself to ask every single question that came to mind. How long do these people live? How many people are in the Northwestern Hemisphere? How does the Northwestern Hemisphere compare to the Southeastern, the Southwestern, and the Northeastern? What is the Northwestern Hemisphere's form of government? How many people are in the government? How do the people of the dominant population dress? Okay, the invisible people, if they're walking around essentially naked, right? What are the ways that they see each other? How do the dominant population see them? How are these people free? How are they oppressed? What do things smell like? What do they eat? What does their food look like? Down to herbs, right? Just so that I had a fuller picture of what was going on, even if I didn't include all of that. And then after I'd finished that doc and had about 7,000 words of world building, I was better able to inhabit the world that I was building and hopefully make it more habitable for readers.
Mm-hmm. And I think you did that. Mission accomplished. The Remoya is something that is referred to throughout. What is the Remoya?
Remoya, in simplest terms, is an invisible's aura that can be perceived by other invisibles. Invisibles cannot perceive the Remoya of a member of the dominant population. I keep saying it in that way. We call them in the book DPs or Dippies, right? And they think that that's due to just a lack of spirit, a lack of vitality that these folks have. I almost gave a couple spoilers away, but a Remoya is like an aura within the book, is defined as a cell spirit. And it is this vitality, this life force that is felt and is perceived through feeling. And is also intrinsically tied to the ancestors of an invisible. And you can almost feel your ancestors in a way guiding you without hearing it. It's more so just a feeling. Yeah, that's all I'm going to say about Remoyas, because there's the Remoyas are incredibly important in this novel, and there's ways in which they shift and shape and make it hard to conceal who you are, but also make it extremely apparent how an invisible is perceived and seen. Yeah. They just, even thinking about them, bring a smile to my face.
This great hemisphere is set 500 years in the future, but there are some things that resonate with our current society. Did that surprise you?
No. I mean, you know, Doug, there are people who have read and finished this book this week, and they say, "Are you clairvoyant? What's going on?" There are things in this book that are literally happening right now or have happened recently. And I'm not prescient. I'm not clairvoyant. I am a student of history. And so much of what is happening today has already happened in different and similar ways throughout recent history. And we can assume throughout the millennia and millennia and millennia of humanity's existence. So whatever is extremely relevant to today that is in the book, it's just an echo of history.
Very well said. Yeah, history repeats over and over. You're absolutely right about that. What do you want readers to take away from this great hemisphere?
This is always a tough question, and believe it or not, you're the first person who has asked me this. There's a lot that I would love the reader to think about. There are many questions that I would like them to ask themselves by the end of the novel and hopefully be able to formulate some of their own answers. But I believe that if I could distill it all down to one thing, I want the reader to question the cyclical nature of history, as we were just speaking about, Doug. That if within this novel there are echoes of the past, if within this novel there are reflections of the present, and if within this novel those reflections and echoes are set 500 years into the future, then how, if at all, can we disrupt the cyclical nature of history? And how, if at all, can we progress as a people and as a species? I'm presenting the question, and it's up to the reader to find an answer that resonates with them. But if they're looking for an answer, then my only answer is this. We act in ways large and small. Instead of doing nothing, we do something. But that something does not have to be on a massive macro scale. I firmly believe that actions that could even be perceived as small will lead to great changes in perception. And if we can more better see ourselves and others as people, then I do firmly believe that this world will become a better place.
Very well said. Extremely well said. Thank you for that. Matteo Escarapore, thank you very much for joining us today. Congratulations on This Great Hemisphere. It is a very powerful novel. I am looking forward to reading your next book and talking to you about it and all the books after that.
Doug, always a pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Matteo Escarapore is the author of This Great Hemisphere. Find out more about Matteo and his expansive novel at wpr.org/beta.
When it came to his music and came to his band, he was totally, utterly colorblind. He used to say, "I don't care if you're black, white, blue, green. If you can play, I want you."
Coming up, biographer James Kaplan will tell us how Miles Davis, John Coltrane, and Bill Evans combined their talents to create the greatest jazz album of all time, Kind of Blue. I'm Doug Gordon. You're listening to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio.
Wisconsin Public Radio provides the largest piece of the funding pie. They make WPR's award-winning news, thought-provoking conversations, and refreshing entertainment possible. Learn more about WPR programs and services at WPR.org.
Support for WGTD comes from the Lake Geneva Symphony, celebrating their upcoming gala, Putting on the Glitz, at the Abbey Resort in Fontana on Saturday, February 8th. More information and tickets are available online at lakegenevaorchestra.org.
This is WPR News.
Hi, I'm Doug Gordon. Welcome back to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio. On August 17th, 1959, Miles Davis made music history. That's when his album Kind of Blue was released. It's a landmark recording that became the best-selling jazz album ever. Novelist, journalist, and biographer James Kaplan is the author of Three Shades of Blue, Miles Davis, John Coltrane, and Bill Evans. Kaplan describes the album as the story of three geniuses, led by Davis, who joined forces to create one of the great classics in Western music. Beta's resident musicologist, Steve Gotcher, sat down with James to discover how these three cool cats collaborated to make this incredible album, which still reigns supreme 65 years later.
Miles was a complicated cat, you know, yes. He called himself the Prince of Darkness, and he turned his back to audiences. And there were times when he expressed his distaste for white people, which I think, given the America that he grew up in, may have been a fairly excusable venial sin. But there was a lot to Miles, and one thing it's important to know about Miles is that when it came to his music and came to his band, he was totally, utterly colorblind. He used to say, "I don't care if you're black, white, blue, green. If you can play, I want you."
In the summer of 1959, we saw the release of Miles Davis's Kind of Blue, which featured a bunch of great players, including Bill Evans on piano and tenor saxophone player John Coltrane. What brought these musicians together for this recording?
It was who brought them together. It was Miles Davis. Miles had an artistic temperament very similar to Picasso. He was restless. He was always moving on to the next thing. He couldn't stand staying in place. But like Picasso, he also had a great artist's sure feeling for how to place the various components of his art. Miles could listen to one player and think, this is somebody I want to place next to my playing. There's a great story about Bill Evans, who came to New York City in 1955 from the hinterlands, a very young man, 29 years old, determined to make it in jazz or go home. And he played a lot of weddings and bar mitzvahs and dances. And he got a job at the Village Vanguard playing in between sets of the Modern Jazz Quartet. Modern Jazz Quartet were then superstars, and Bill Evans was nobody. When the Modern Jazz Quartet played at the Vanguard, the place went dead silent. When they took their break, everybody and Bill Evans started to play, because that was his job, play during their break. Everybody started, the dishes started to clink, the glasses, the silverware, people started talking. One night, while Bill Evans was encountering all this distraction while trying to play his beautifully subtle piano, he looks down at the end of the grand piano, and there, under the lid, are the penetrating eyes of Miles Davis. Miles is there checking out Evans, and a week later, Miles calls Bill Evans on the phone out of the blue and says, "Join my band." And when Miles said, "Join my band," you joined Miles' band. Similar thing happened with Coltrane and everybody else on that album.
Well, let's talk a little bit about the studio session. What were they like? Were they doing improvisation, or were they doing written out pieces?
Miles was the great exponent of improvisation. And so he knew that the musicians he had hired for the kind of blues sessions were so brilliant that all he had to show them ahead of time was the tiniest little sketch of what he had in mind for each number. He would write out a couple of musical notes, just sketch them out on a napkin or a piece of paper, and say something to them a little bit about who would solo where, who would solo when, what the chord progression was going to be, and then they were off. And the jaw-dropping, astonishing fact about Kind of Blue, and we must remember what Bill Evans said, that no musician ever goes into a studio for a recording session on a Wednesday morning and knows he's going to make a great album. It doesn't work that way. These were two sessions in March and April of 1959. And the amazing thing is that every full take on that album, except for one, was a first take.
Wow, that's amazing. How was Kind of Blue received when it first came out?
It was Kind of Blue was received with a certain amount of puzzlement in many quarters. It was a brand new thing, a brand new sound. It was extremely quiet, but much too quiet for a lot of critics. There were a number of critics who said, this is pretty music, but it lacks force, it lacks power. It's not dynamic enough. We don't like it. But a couple of critics were astute enough to realize that this was genius, this was history, and this was an album like no other. It truly is an album that's outside of time.
When did Kind of Blue become recognized as the legendary album that it's considered to be today?
I think it took a few years. I think that sales were steady, but not gigantic. There weren't the initial big sales there had been for the Columbia albums Miles did with Gil Evans. Kind of Blue took a while to get its strong footing commercially, but then it just held on and kept selling, first in gradual increments and then steeper increments, and has just continued to hold on to this day.
Why is it that you decided to focus on John Coltrane and Bill Evans in addition to Miles Davis for this book?
Well, after I finished the book before this, I had written a biography of Irving Berlin for Yale University Press Jewish Lives series, I needed an idea for my next book. And I went out to lunch with my editor at Penguin Press, Scott Moyers, and he proposed a book about Kind of Blue. My build on Scott Moyers's, on my editor's idea, was what about a book about the three, arguably the three geniuses of Kind of Blue? That's Miles and Coltrane and Bill Evans. What about them as men and musicians before, during, and after the making of this timeless album? There were six musicians on Kind of Blue. So there were Miles and Coltrane and Evans. There was also Cannonball Adderley. And there was Paul Chambers on bass, a great bassist. And there was Jimmy Cobb, the drummer. And Jimmy Cobb was an excellent jazz drummer. But I think an argument can be made, and I hope I made it in my book, that if there were any geniuses on that album, it really was those three men and great artists. And they were all equally troubled artists throughout their lives and at various points in their lives, junctures in their lives, passages in their lives, extremely troubled. All three of them for years, respectively, were heroin addicts. Right. And Evans stayed an addict to the end of his days.
So after Kind of Blue, Miles Davis and Bill Evans and John Coltrane all headed in different directions and had great solo careers. Where did John Coltrane take his music?
He took his music to the outer limits of the universe. And within, I think it was just about 3 weeks after the second and final session for Kind of Blue, that Coltrane went and recorded the Giant Steps, which was exactly what the title says. It was a giant step ahead for the tenor saxophone, for jazz itself, and for Coltrane. Coltrane, like so many players, like so many horn players, like so many saxophonists, suffered for years under the titanic and diabolical influence of Charlie Parker. Charlie Parker, the greatest saxophonist who ever lived, was also the biggest heroin addict in jazz. And so many jazz musicians suffered this terrible illusion that if you want to play like Bird, you have to do like Bird. And they took up the drug, and it killed a lot of people. It almost killed Coltrane, but it didn't. He had to find his own path after imitating Charlie Parker. He had to not imitate Charlie Parker and find his own way, and he did. Coltrane had a way of taking chords and finding parts to chords in jazz that nobody had ever thought of before. Coltrane found new notes to play and new astronomical heights to take his playing that even left a lot of jazz musicians behind. There were people, a lot of people grew very impatient with Coltrane, but Coltrane had an artistic path. He had a trajectory, a creative trajectory that was very steep, very difficult. After A Love Supreme, which is such a masterpiece, he began to explore these interplanetary realms with his saxophone. And Coltrane was just on his own path. And it was not a function of selfishness. He was an explorer, and he took the art farther than anybody had before him.
And what about Bill Evans? He took a different tack.
Well, a lot of people complain that Bill Evans didn't go very far artistically. I think that's not true. One of the wonderful interviews I got to do for my book was with the great young pianist, composer, a brilliant man named John Batiste, who for a while was the band leader on the Colbert Show. John Batiste has tremendous respect for Bill Evans and felt that in many ways Bill Evans went farther than Coltrane or Miles. Bill Evans continued to play in the trio format for the rest of his short career. He played beautiful, 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 very subtle music, highly influenced by the Western classical moderns. Stravinsky, Ravel was a huge influence on Bill Evans. He had incomparable touch, incomparable subtlety. I think that his touch and his subtlety were vitiated in his later years by his switching from heroin to cocaine. suddenly a pianist who had always slumped down low over the keys to coax the most subtle sounds out of the piano was sitting bolt upright and playing a little faster. Arguably, that was the influence of cocaine.
And then Miles Davis seemed to take probably the most experimental path. At least he changed his styles from album to album until he got to very electronic music. How does his career progress?
He incorporates a lot of the quiet that he found with Kind of Blue, but then he picks up electronic instruments. He becomes more and more compromised physically. The trumpet is an extremely physically difficult instrument to play. He became more of almost like an impresario or a conductor than a player among players in his later albums. He switched from trumpet to electronic organ, electronic keyboard. And so he, in a lot of his concerts in the 1970s and 80s, he would play mostly keyboard and maybe an occasional single note on the trumpet. It was experimental, but it was also necessary given his physical limitations. You had albums as varied as In a Silent Way and Feed to Kilimanjaro and Jack Johnson and On the Corner. Miles was fascinated by rap. Miles loved Sly Stone. He loved Prince. He wanted to forge artistic alliances with these great young artists. Miles saw the future.
Now, if you had the power of being able to see into the future, how do you think people are going to look at Kind of Blue in 2059?
2059, 100 years. Well, 2059, that's not that far away. It's 35 years from now. So I think it's going to continue on its timeless path. I think that as long as people are listening to music, as long as there is music, there will be Kind of Blue. It'll be a record that moves listeners as much 50 and 100 years from now as it does today.
James Kaplan, thank you so much for joining us today and for your excellent work on Three Shades of Blue. It's a fantastic look at the making of one of the greatest jazz albums ever.
Steve, thank you so much. It was a great pleasure talking with you today.
James Kaplan is the author of Three Shades of Blue, Miles Davis, John Coltrane, and Bill Evans. Steve Gotcher talked to him. Find out more about James and Three Shades of Blue at wpr.org/beta. Well, that does it for this edition of Beta. Thanks to our guests, Paul Scheer, Matteo Escarapore, and James Kaplan.
They have a lot of zany stuff on this program, don't you think?
Beta is available to follow on Spotify or wherever you catch your favorite pods. Don't forget to offer a rating or share with new alphas. You can keep up with us during the week online at wpr.org/beta.
Even for the internet, it's pretty shocking.
Beta is a production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Red Meat Productions.
Fantastic.
Our music and technical director is Steve Gotcher.
Make fun of me all you want. I'm in peak performance mode.
Our executive producer is Adam Friedrich.
You know, I do talk a lot of smack, guys, but it's only because I can beep, beep, back it up.
And thanks to you, our alphas. More Beta comes your way next week. Until then, I'm Doug Gordon.
I love it. I'm a king there. They love me.
Got questions about changes we've made here on WPR? We set up wpr.org/new so you can find everything you need, including schedules, station maps, and more. Visit wpr.org/new.
I'm Gregory Berg. The studios of WGTD will be closed from December 28th through January 1st for the holidays, and during that time there will be no morning show broadcast. But each and every day there will be a different morning show podcast episode for you to enjoy, with interviews drawn from the morning show archives. The podcast version of The Morning Show is available wherever you get your podcasts, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, but be sure to look for the right name, The Morning Show with Greg Berg. This is WGTD HD 91.1 Kenosha Racine, 101.7.